Hello, BattleTech fans, and welcome to the Renegade HVG podcast. My name is Travis, and my guest today is Brent Evans. Brent came to the BattleTech as a portrait and line artist. Over time, has come to assume the roles of both art director and line developer. I'm looking forward to musing on that history with him today as we take a deep dive into the current state of BattleTech art. Brent, thanks for sitting down with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been fun. Kind of looking over your stuff and kind of getting ready for this, you know, I listened to the wonderful AMA you guys did. I think it was about a year and a half, two years ago with all your staff. And that was a fun conversation. You know, there's certainly some questions, you know, I kind of pulled out of that to kind of develop on, but you had mentioned in that conversation that you came into around the kind of Clicky Tech time period, as an illustrator for that. And, you know, I want to kind of go back to that time and chat a little bit about kind of what that early experiences was like and how, I guess, how the character of the company, you know, because obviously it's a different company back then, how the character of kind of the IP holder has evolved over time and how you've seen that kind of from that inside perspective.
Wow. Yeah, it has evolved dramatically different, you know, because obviously back in the early days, it was all under one roof. By the time I got involved with it, Jordan had cut it up into pieces and sold it to everybody. And not all the teams wanted to play nicely with each other. So that was unique. But what specifics do you want to know?
Well, certainly kind of in the evolution of the game and kind of where the focus is, you know, for the art, I suppose in the source books, you know, kind of looking back there, you know, the proliferation of what you guys are doing now is certainly seems like it increased, but I would assume that the staff has increased as well. So maybe not necessarily the workload has increased in time. Perhaps it has with the Kickstarter. But for you, you know, I've seen a lot of both line art for mechs from you and characters and portraits. You know, did you have a preference of kind of which you kind of worked on and kind of how did you fall into each in terms of your contributions to the universe?
Oh, sure. Across the 90s, I was actually drawing comic stuff, mm-hmm. comic book stuff. So I've always been a line art guy and a designer. Those are really my two big skills. And, you know, I started off, ultimately, Jordan hired me to work on Mech Warrior, you know, Mech Clicks. He hired me specifically for the design skill. And it helped that I was incredibly knowledgeable about the property. When he brought me in, I think I actually was this like they brought in a ringer. I was the subject matter expertise in BattleTech, mm-hmm. More than anyone else at WizKids,
yeah,
at the time. And they brought me in because they were behind on a bunch of other stuff. They brought in another artist from DreamWorks who didn't have any experience whatsoever with MechWarrior or BattleTech, and most of the team was a little, let's say, disparaging, mm-hmm. of those old of the aesthetics of it. Which, to be positive about it, the truth is a lot of that old art style stuff was very campy 1985. Totally. And they wanted to be more modern, but in their head, more modern meant manga.
Okay.
Which was not the functional identity globally of BattleTech. So like when you have feet that are larger than the torso, that's the proportions are totally out of whack. You know, that kind of stuff. You get away with that in manga, but doesn't necessarily play well with the BattleTech brand. With that said, though, at the time they were producing, you know, Clicky Tech was, it was selling a ridiculous volume of product. It was actually a huge hit. And in my opinion, the ultimate fall of Clicky Tech was that the pre-assembled, pre-painted figures were just so expensive to produce. They were fighting the math with every release. So that was ultimately the biggest problem with Clicky Tech. And Jordan did some miraculous, magical things trying to get that to function as long as he could.
Right.
But the nuance of manufacturing and costs and all that other stuff all played into, you know, fighting the tide. So that's where that all happened. But what was interesting is that, you know, after my stint at WizKids, you know, I got home and Randall Bills had an email in my inbox saying, hey, we want you to work on Battletech. And so that I instantly went over to line work. And the funny thing was that I got hired to do design work in Battletech, but the first project that he gave me was the 3050 upgrade technical readout, which means I was not allowed to redesign anything. I'm like, please let me make this cool. Some of these stuff, like this stuff is like, he gave me the katana first and the shogun. He said, try to make these cool. I'm like, I can't make those cool. I can. He's like, you can't deviate from the miniatures. I'm like, oh okay. Oh, well, boy. I can just give you the best illustration I can of that, and that'll be what it is. But at the time, that was black. You know, black and white line art was the aesthetic for the line, and that was very common in gaming. The gaming market hadn't shifted over to full color and rendered, so it worked at the time.
And you said that, you know, there was a lot of dissonance, I suppose, in the staff there with the Clicky Tech in terms of what Battletech was. Is that something that kind of improved in time, or was that something that persisted through that stage of Battletech's history?
Oh, yeah, it improved organically, mainly because Clicky Tech stopped.
Yeah.
And then Battletech, as they started bringing in the Clicky Tech stuff into canon, we were allowed to do some evolving, do some shifting, you know, bring in Doug Chaffee to try to make it look better. After the 3050 upgrade, Matt Plogg and I were also allowed to, like, go ahead and do the art for this, but you can go ahead and change it. You can make it better. And we started doing just kind of that normal evolution thing that happens organically to bring those designs in so they were more compatible with the aesthetics that had kept Battletech alive for so long. And it's interesting from a creative team perspective. I don't think most fans quite grasp the intentional process you have to go through. So for instance, when Randall Bills hired me to start doing new designs for Battletech, I think it was, I need you to do 50 designs. And you're like, okay, great. I get to do 50 mechas. That just sounds like a dream project. That's awesome. But keep in mind, they can't look like any mechas in Battletech, and they can't look like any mechas in any other mecha property in the world. Well, you know, any creative person is going to be, okay, well, I can follow my creative vision and get some inspiration and stuff, and I can, you know, a good one will be able to crank out 15, 20, maybe 25 of the outside good ideas. You know, designs that are actually like, man, this is cool and unique. You got some really neat stuff there we've never seen before. But yeah, you try to mine 50?
Yeah.
50 things that don't look like anything else in a sea where, you know, like in 1985, there was very few other things that you had to avoid looking like. Now there are so many things you have to avoid looking at, looking like. And so, yeah, just trying to make sure that whatever we designed was unique enough to stand on its own and match the aesthetics for Battletech, which had a very different vibe than almost all other mecha. And this was before the first Transformers movie, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
And I was like, well, why don't you just do what they did for Transformers? I'm like, okay, but once again, they did that to make it look like Transformers. That's not how you make Battletech mechs. You know, Battletech mechs, these are gigantic tanks. They don't do somersaults. They don't dodge lasers. They don't, you know, do ninja kicks or flips in the air. Like, that's not what makes Battletech. These things have weight. They have mass. They move slowly. They're lumbering. And you have to treat them appropriately. Otherwise, it gets very not Battletech very, very fast. So the thought process from a creative side of how do you maintain the Titanic walking tank aesthetic when trying to redesign a whole bunch of new designs, and usually under a ridiculously short period of time. Because at the time, the creative process was the designers would design the product, the developers would figure out what they want in that, then they'd hand it off to the author team. The writers would write the content. And then whatever time was left over would get handed to the artist, like, here's your deadline. Well, in every single case, the writers went past the developers and the writers would completely blow the timetable and would be like, okay, now you're the artist. You this assignment was actually due 3 weeks ago. Crank these out as fast as you can. Well, that's like trying to bleed, you know, get blood from a stone. Especially if you're trying, yeah, any good artist can do, I can give you a handful like that. That's no problem. You ask me to do 50 like that, that's a big thing. And then you get done with that. You're like, oh man, this was, I'm so glad we got this done. This is such a major project. Great. Now we need 50 more. How many times can you keep pulling the miracles out of miscellaneous orifices and stuff? So that's kind of the nuances of the painful side of that part of the process. But on the positive side, when they brought me on and I started doing stuff after the 3050, one of the next big projects that I got, as Randall asked me to design the mechs that the Ward of Blake would use to fight all of the houses and all of the clans at once. And I said, okay, why don't you connect me with the development team? Connect me with the writers and the developers. So we're all working on it together. So I can hear the thought, you know, like we can all be a part of that lightning in a bottle. And can bounce ideas off of each other. Over the course of that project, just doing what became known as the Celestials, I ended up redesigning all of the Celestials three times. But every time I did it, like the creators were like, okay, that's really great. We can do this. Okay, now, hold on a second. My dog's about to bark. But so like I would come up with sketches of like, here's what you just asked for. Like, okay, that's really great. But can we go this far? I'm like, yeah, actually we can. And if we do, we can do that. And so we did this bounce back and forth thing. And Randall Bell's watching the whole thing. This was the first project that Randall wasn't, he didn't have to like orchestrate. He's just watching it all happen as everybody works together. And what we did is we created a collaborative parallel development cycle on a creative product, where instead of saying it goes in this linear fashion, it's let's put us all together. We'll just do everything at once. And it ended up shortening the development time cycle by like 60%.
And the incredible
results ended up being so much better than before. And so after the course of that process, Randall went to the Catalyst bosses and said, we need to bring in Brent to do that with everything. Because I speak business and I speak artist.
Right.
And he spoke business, but he didn't speak artist. You know, like you can be a project manager, but if you can't actually get to the granular level of, I need you to improve this specific thing and let me walk you through how to do it. That's not something that he ever brought to the table. And he saw me do that over the course of this process. And he's like, let's get Brent in to do that. So that's ultimately how I got asked to take over the reins to be the art director for Catalyst.
Yeah, that's an invaluable skill. Certainly, I've seen that a lot in kind of my own, and that, like you said, that balance between the business side, understanding that overview and the considerations that are made, plus the actual practical side of producing is extremely rare. Over the course of 12 years, I found, I think, out of maybe 60 employees, maybe two or three that, had that talent. It's very rare.
And you see a lot of people try to do it, but mm-hmm. if it's not their natural skill, it ends up kind of sucking the wind out of the creative side of inspiration and creative genius and stuff. And that ends up being counterproductive if it's not the right fit. You just got to find the right fit.
Yeah. And then I've seen a lot too, where, the people in charge, Randall in this case, there's not the humility to kind of let that new person come in into that role. And so that's awesome to, that all those kind of pieces came together, that kind of Randall was there to identify that and you had the talent to bring in. Cause I'm sure that kind of jump-started the production rate.
It made a huge difference. And it was at a weird time where things were shifting and evolving. Mm-hmm. The fall of the Clicks game kind of coincided with the crashing of miniatures production overseas. Okay. There was just a time with the economy where things shifted domestically. And it wasn't just in the U.S. There was a variety of major gaming countries around the world that their things shifted and adjusted. This is right around the time of the countries trying to recover from the economic collapse in the housing market. And those companies defaulted on all these Chinese producers. It suddenly became really, really hard to get Chinese plastic miniatures produced in China. Mm-hmm. Something like 40% of, something like 4 out of 5. So 80% of the companies producing in China for gaming either went out of business or dramatically changed their terms. And so it became a whole lot harder. So all of a sudden, the BattleTech line couldn't produce miniatures. And that's really tough when you're creating a miniatures game. So yeah, there was this year, if you think about it, there was this span, like 10 years ago to about 5 years ago, where BattleTech was only alive because of source books. There weren't novels, there weren't miniatures, there weren't maps, there weren't dice. And, you know, you kind of need all five of those things to play the game. So, you know, trying to get in a new player to BattleTech meant, okay, now go to eBay and try to buy some maps that were created with a marker in 1987. And that's not a great way to bring in, you know, new players.
Totally.
So, yeah. Just funny little things. Things we've overcome. Just the long-term view, systematic chipping away at the obstacles to get a revitalization of a game line that is totally worthy, but it took that amount of effort to get it to be what it is now, which I kind of think BattleTech now is a global phenomenon.
Yeah,
what 40-year-old properties have you seen that are as thriving as BattleTech?
Yeah, it's been awesome to see. I had stepped away from it, I think around 99, 2000, when I was freshman in college and just couldn't find anyone to play and always kept my stuff. I had, you know, it was, you know, one of my favorites as a teen. I tell the story frequently, but my middle school English teacher once came to me and was like, you know, for my book reports, because I would do BattleTech book reports every week. And it's like, these are great, but can you read something else? Like, yeah, I can do that. And then I didn't. So I just kept doing BattleTech books. But no, it was fun. But in 2018, I kind of, you know, my box had always traveled with me, my little legal box of BattleTech stuff, and I busted it out. I was like, yeah, I gotta, you know, I have some time. I want to get back into this. And yeah, I was talking about the right time, you know, in 2019 came around, and then, you know, everything's blown up. So it's been really fun to kind of to witness that resurgence. I want to talk a little bit about the mechs, because this has been an interesting subject for me and kind of what a mech is. And I've, you know, had a lot of wonderful guests, Sam Lewis being one of kind of my favorites. And, you know, I asked him kind of in the early stage of what does he envision a mech? And I've seen, you see MechWarrior Online, which kind of has played a large role in kind of the reimagining
Absolutely.
Of the mechs. But it's also grounded in a video game and the limitations of a video game. And Alex in his redesigns has those kind of, you know, those walls that he's got to work within, you know, whereas in kind of the early BattleTech, you know, before there were 3D and whatnot, you know, there was a lot more freedom in terms of the athletics, how the mechs moved and whatnot. And I had asked Sam, you know, how does he envision it? Like on the spectrum of, you know, kind of a mech warrior online to a Robotech or something in terms of motion. And he had pulled up, Pacific Rim kind of as his go-to of what it was. And you were talking about kind of in the walking tanks there. And I'm curious in terms of where you are now and how that has evolved. Has there always been, is yours kind of a modern imagining of what was consistent throughout the years, or has that actually changed and kind of gone, you know, more to kind of a more agile movement to a more kind of heavy walking tank?
Man, that is an awesome question, and there's so many nuances to it. I would actually say, if anything, the concept of what is a mech for BattleTech has actually even gotten more firm back into that it is a walking tank. But recognizing that there are different eras of tanks, you know, like there was World War I era tanks versus World War II era tanks versus, you know, 1980s era tanks versus modern day tanks. And when you realize the degree of technological difference, I mean, they from the exterior shells, they don't look all that different, honestly, but knowing what's going on internally is massive. So I think in no uncertain terms, BattleTech of what is a mecha? It has to be a walking tank, because that's the only way to really wrap the mind around of its place and usage in the battlefield. You know, if you have a mech with no support, that's got strengths but big giant weaknesses. If you do combined arms, okay, that's a way to resolve the issues with that. But there's a whole lot of logistical support things that go into having a combined arms unit and being able to tactically deal with the nuances of that. Honestly, a lot of that stuff is where all the magic is. And therefore, when we have stories where a mech warrior, you know, sees like, oh snap, I'm the only one that can solve this, you know, something's happening on the battlefield. There's some objective that's about to get toast. Nobody else can get to it. I'm going to have to break away from all my support. I'm going to be the one that stands on the line and holds that line. If the sense was you are invincible in a tank, or, you know, in a battle mech, and nothing can touch you, well, then that's not very heroic. You're just standing there doing your job. If you realize, if I go over there, I you know, no one else can get there. I can get there. I'm the only one that can get there because I have this movement. I have jump jets. I have this. Now I'm the one. I'm literally like the little boy at the dam holding his finger in the hole, and you can't move. Even though you are where you need to be, you are stronger than an infantry on the field, but you have so many weaknesses and you are taking such a risk. This is that hero moment. And that's where that balance of being in a battle mech doesn't make you a god. And a lot of other mecha properties don't have that perspective, that paradigm.
Right.
I mean, really, if you think about Pacific Rim, you know, like, yeah, okay, there was two people in the cockpit, and that was awesome. Honestly, I thought the design and stuff on that was so fantastic. But, you know, like, they walk out and they really, that made them a god. There was nothing that could stand up against them other than an evil god version of the opponent. And it was just a one-on-one. There wasn't a collective team there working together to try to come up with ways to overcome the insurmountable. And so just from the point of crafting a worthy story and giving the fan base worthy characters through which they could tell that story, I still think BattleTech is the strongest property on the market, gaming property for that. It just does the best job.
So I want to take advantage of kind of having you here and kind of push back on some of that from my own experience, because my background as athletics, you know, as a athlete and as a coach, and so I've seen a lot of, you know, the ability to visually recognize movement and kind of separate that uncanny valley of movement is something that I've developed over time. And so what I see in kind of the current designs is I have trouble seeing kind of the lateral turning motion. And so, you know, in some of the designs that I'm, you know, how in kind of your development and how you're seeing it, because I know in Mech Warrior Online, it's very, you walk forward, you kind of step side, but there's not kind of that lateral twisting and turning, you know, which is, you know, present certainly in BattleTech. And how, when you're developing your designs and kind of with this, kind of how do you account for that in those designs? And is it something that you can or can't do based on the fact that ultimately these got to become miniatures? You know, how have you accounted for it? And I got a follow-up question once you got that done for a moment.
Yeah, especially with modern designs, it's one thing when you're talking about the old originals. That was one thing, because those, you kind of nostalgically, they need to look clunky. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing new ones, like, how far do we toe the line on that? And ultimately, it always comes back to two things. There's a game design theory that's called the mechanic is the message. You make sure that the rules and the story around the item match the mechanic that you're trying to generate for the game, so that reinforces. So in this case, the lateral movement, yeah, there's not really good lateral movement with, especially with mecha and tanks too. Like, you have to turn, and the mechanic for that in gameplay is you have to take up one of those. You have X amount of movement. If you can go 5'8", you have to use up a movement point every time you want to turn, because you can't just rotate your hips. Mechs don't do that. You have to functionally do it to go that direction, and then once again turn and then go farther that direction. So that's one of those elements that we intentionally don't take too far. Now, with that said, there's hand waving. You have to have hand waving when you're talking about mecha. Otherwise, we would all be walking around like, it would be ridiculous. So, we behind the scenes, we do argue like, okay, is this a ball joint? Is this like, how are we making this one work? You know, you really look at the awesome, and they have those massive shoulder actuators and the armor around it, and you realize it can only do this. It's right. A karate chop, right? It can't go wide. And so every time you see it spreading its arms out, you're like, yeah, well, just going to hand wave him that. Yeah. Sure, that can do that. But yeah, you do the best you can with it, but you try to just do enough of a nod so that it feels right without truly jacking things up.
Yeah, I see. Whenever I see kind of the missile, the laser ports coming out of the torso, and assuming that they're not all shooting at the same thing, I just kind of imagine, the fembots and Austin Powers, and they're just like
exactly
they're just like shooting their missiles, target there, target
yep
there, all within 10 seconds, of course.
yeah In my head, the mounts for those torso weapons, I'm not talking about missile racks, because missile racks, they kind of have a box. Boxes mounted in the individual warheads can be semi-self-targeting. But for the, especially like lasers and guns that are in the torso, in my head, their mounting has, it's not a hard mounting. It has some flexibilities for the targeting, fine motor control, basically. Otherwise, it just doesn't really make, it would, you'd only hit the things you're facing, which
which means you're turning a lot. The other one, and this is kind of a more of a thought experiment, I don't have the expertise, either in math or biomechanics to pursue it, but I can recognize biomechanics in terms of speed of motion. So how a sprinter looks when they're sprinting, how a running back looks when they're running, how a sumo wrestler looks when they're moving. And things in terms of keeping that walking tank, those things tend to kind of start to break down in my mind. And I want your rebuttal on this. When you start to hit like fire moth level speeds, Hermes 2 level speeds, and that requires the degree of kind of motion, a suppleness of movement that isn't always kind of captured in the modern art. Is that another hand wavium? Do you guys think about that as you're going? Have you ever sat down and kind of, how do we break this down? How long is a step, actually? And what does that look like when a mech is running at that speed?
Yeah, there's definitely a degree of hand wavium. There's no way to ignore that. I will say, Matt Plogg, when he did the 3055 upgrade, and he took a bunch of just the ugliest designs, the most non-functional looking designs, and he actually posed them in action poses and made them feel like they would be right. It's almost like Matt took athletes as his models and then formed the bits and pieces over. I think like the fireball running and I think the Hitman's in that one. Like there's a bunch of weird designs in there that really don't look functional, but somehow Matt made them amazing.
Yeah.
And so we always try to keep those moments of finding a way to make it feel possible. I will admit, occasionally you just embrace the impossible. I think one of my images was, a hatchet man with the hatchet like fully held over out to the side, and I'm like, okay, there's no way that actuator is actually
the arms are gonna do that.
let's just completely ignore the fact this is not possible because it looks really cool. And what's funny is that quite often, like Randall Bilson was like, yeah, we'll ignore the fact that that's not possible because that just looks so awesome. So yeah, we do acknowledge that sometimes, but we all talk about it behind, like, are we going to let you get away with this one this time? Yeah, we bust each other's chops on it behind the closed doors.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Rule of cool for me is always got to take priority, unless you're like too crazy or something.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things with the artists. You have the creative freedom to your number one objective, your primary objective, get me an awesome looking image.
Yeah,
that's the number one. Now here's the stuff I'm going to give you that I want in that image, but you can drop some of this stuff if you get me an amazing looking image. So that's usually where the
I love it. Certainly, the things you escape with the 2D side, but I've probably the most frequent guest I think I've had on Renegade HPG is Dan Bruins, and his wonderful animations and his the movement in that is just wonderful. And between that and the kind of the time I spent on the cartoon, there's just a lot of kind of thought put into that kind of the motion side of things, which is kind of what inspired those questions. Putting your feet to the fire a little bit about kind of where things might break down. On the redesign, another one that I'm really interested in and I've been trying to kind of pursue on my own as a fan and commissioning fan art is the elemental battle armor, which is a favorite when I was younger, and I'm curious about kind of your thought process in terms of the redesign of that. And
the original elemental or the one from the Mechflix game?
The original. So Spencer's battle armor for the elemental.
Yeah.
And kind of the redesign, kind of more of a kind of a rounded bulbous kind of redesign that you guys have gone with.
We fought, we really went over that over and over and over and over. I think I think we did 17 or 18 tweak variations on things just to try to dial, like, it basically is like, what proportions really should this shell have?
Yeah.
You know, where would the guy's arm end in the laser lower arm? Like, because like a lot of that stuff, it looks like there's a laser barrel on there, but you realize that would be like from, he lose his wrist and his hand
Yeah,
completely.
yeah,
Like,
yeah.
there's just so many things in there. Like, how do you make it work? And then ultimately, not only does it make work, but how does it look right or feel right? We really did give Anthony a long rope on that one. And he, because we wanted to explore the possibilities, explore the ways we could do this, and how could we make it look? And then I dialed him in, I reined him in really hard. And he tried it my way, and then he pushed back, and we ended up with a back and forth that kind of ended up in the middle of how do you want the shape of the helmet to work? How do you want, I think the biggest diversion was actually on the SRM packs. You know, Randall was like hardcore, they have to be the old triangles. We can't get away from the old triangles. Ray was like, he's a grognard, so he's like, yeah, it should be the old triangles, but I hate the clans, so screw them. Let's give Anthony some room. I was like, just so long as it's a triangular shape, I'm good. And then Anthony turned in something that I'm like, okay, well, I meant more triangular shape. And he's like, no, this is the way it should be. And one of the more unusual parts of the discussion that we went through, as particularly on the Elemental, was that we knew how small it would be produced. And we really, really, really wanted the details on the redesigns to be able to have a rookie gamer painter be able to paint them with a, you know, level zero amount of skill and still come out with a decent looking miniature on the tabletop.
Right.
So it's weird when you look at like some of the details, like why is there like, there's like these thick ridges, and why are there like the panels are really, really blatant and the seams are really obnoxious. Like I could shoot into the seam. Like that's an obvious reason. But a lot of that came down to, we needed to bring these things to life and know full well that they're going to end up going really, really small. Like this is I think it ended up being 1.6 centimeters, which is a tiny thing. And so I'm not kidding. Not only were we fighting about the design of what should the suit look like, we were also printing up prototypes. Prototypes, okay, if we scale it to here, if we scale it to here, if we scale it to what, how big should it be if it was accurate, and how big should it be because it's being made as a miniature? And then we were contacting the manufacturer, like, okay, let's talk about shrinkage and plastics as they come out of the molds, if they're done at a specific temperature, how does that affect the shrinkage, because it's going to change the surfaces on the shapes and stuff, because quite a lot on those early stuff, they were coming out as blobs. We were losing definition, we were losing shape. We ended up, over the course of all of the redesigns, increasing the amount of time, requiring the manufacturer to increase the amount of time that the plastic was in the mold before they separated the, like popped it open and separated it out.
Yeah.
Just because the popping motion, like every second you leave it in there more decreases the amount of deformation that happens when just from popping.
Right.
And from there it's like, okay, well now where does it go when you pop it? Does it fall straight into a cool thing of water, or is it bouncing off of a tabletop surface or being thrown into a bucket? Like any number of things. That's just the realities of the production process. So we went back and forth on the Elemental in particular a ton of times, way less so on the new one, because in the new Kickstarter, you know, we had the Intersphere Battle Armor, which is the first real infantry unit in plastic that we're doing following the Elemental suit. And admittedly, those are supposed to look more clunky. They're supposed to look less cool. So in a lot of ways, that made them easier to produce. But we'd also, you know, worked with the manufacturer to go through all of the reality, real-world processes of how do we design and make a figure at this size, that we had that under our belts, and we kind of worked out the fine-tuning on that one. So that helped quite a bit. The second one was not as painful, but we really agonized over the Elemental. In fact, so much so that the three model files for the original Elemental were so big, we couldn't send them to each other. I had to use like a high file size file transfer protocol. And I still use it to this day, outsourcer that sends massive files back and forth, because we're sending things, you know, all over the place, but it, originally I needed it because we couldn't, none of us could open the Elemental file on our computer.
Just, yeah, that'd
we
be
went
a
so big and it's like, let's get it dialed down and then we can simplify. But it was all part of the organic process and trying to figure out how do we do this. So, yeah. But,
yeah, it's fascinating to hear kind of how all those things overlap in it. And it seems like it ties into kind of what Randall brought you in specifically, and that ability to kind of overlap all these processes and how without that, I can't imagine the nightmare that would have been if you were like, Anthony, design this, and then let's take it to China, and then China can't do it, and then we bring it back and all that. And so the ability to have all those things working organically and overlapping.
Well, what's funny is without not only bringing me in, but then bringing in, you know, my bringing in Anthony to handle the 3D models, even with all the stuff with Anthony, we would turn the files over to China. And most people don't know this. Almost every producer in China, like, they have their machines. And just like here in the United States, the machines have their own proprietary software. So in China, when we send them 3D models, I believe that they then rebuild those models from scratch.
Really? Oh, wow.
I don't even know that they still use, that they use, they may take ours in as like orthographics and then they try to rebuild, but they, for every single one of them, they charge us like, we pay to do the 3D models on our end. We turn them over and then we pay them to rebuild their 3D models, but it's because it has to be rebuilt for whatever software their machines need.
Right.
And we've fought them over and over about it. And I think we got it down to a reasonable price now. We've pretty much gotten that down. But yeah, it's in the olden days, you would send your files or just your design sketches to China. And then you would get what you get. That's how the MetClicks game was done. And that's why there was a dramatically different range of scales on things. You had light mechs that were bigger than assault mechs, and like, the Cougar was so big it could barely fit on the click style, and you know, like all these are, that's because they were being modeled by Chinese people that don't know anything about Battletech,
right?
And there was no overseeing. It was like, hey, here's your model. I'm like, okay, I'll take what I can get because we had no other option.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that's not the way it is now. And having Anthony's team, where you know, so we send them the 3D files, the Chinese manufacturer does whatever they do, whether they're modifying the files we send them or rebuilding them from scratch. They now send them back to us. We send them to Anthony, and Anthony will quality control proof check everything about their production model. And having Anthony's ability to go in and he'll spin it 360, like top, bottom. Okay, we got this factor here. This thing's weird. This, something's up with your model here. Let's fix this and send that back. And then China will then produce the masters, take high res photos of them and send them back to us, and then Anthony will give another round of edits. Okay, this, you've got too much shining, this one you need to smooth this out, this part needs some follow-up, this part wasn't done right. And so adding in those extra steps, it's like we added three different steps of quality control to it. Night and day difference. It made all the difference in the world. And honestly, that's not even said, that was so far beyond my skill level. That was Anthony in every way, shape and form. And he's just, he was definitely the brilliant inventor we needed. He was the Anthony Stark that we needed to bring in to figure out how to make this possible.
And is there, for you guys, because I know you guys tried to do plastics about a decade ago, you know, in the early CGO with the larger Atlas cover box sets. Is there, at that time, there were other plastic miniatures, certainly things like Games Workshop and whatnot, that have a higher level of detail than those had. Is there a hierarchy in terms of who has access to different levels of quality manufacturer, or is it just a matter of, you know, trying to find those people or find people that have availability?
Absolutely. And it's shifted quite a bit. So not only has the production ability shifted over the course of the last 15 years, the market, what the market wants has changed. So when we did
I think are Hold you on. You're looking for an Alpha Strike pack, I can help you out because I've got one right behind me.
No, the
box.
The introductory box set.
I've got that behind me too. Give me one second.
Do you have it? Yeah, the box with the baggie of mechs.
Yeah, I love that. When I was first getting back into BattleTech, that was the prime product. I think it was going for like $200 or something on eBay. But there we go.
There you go. There we go. So when we produced the introductory box set, the market did not care about quality. This was
Interesting.
meant to be an introductory box so that the whole thing was the maximum number of minis you can get so that a beginning player can start playing and they will naturally graduate to go Ironwind Metals. That was the premium line. So if they want quality, go Ironwind Metals. If you want just to get kids playing the game, this is what you get. You get a baggie full of mechs. And I'm not kidding. I think the baggie of it's what, 20 mechs?
24.
24 mechs.
Yeah, plus two
I think that
premium.
was
So yeah.
$2.30 cost to produce 24 minis. If you look at the cost for a single Games Workshop mini, it's 10 times that. So, and at the time there was Games Workshop, and Games Workshop has absolutely upped their game since then. So Games
Yeah.
Workshop, like the quality out of Games Workshop is insane. But keep in mind, Games Workshop almost bankrupted their company building their own 3D or product plastic productions facilities that do nothing but produce their own stuff. They built their own.
Yeah.
And that's how they get to do it. So the hierarchy for everybody else, and I will say everybody else, and they just know that there's air quotes around, but not Cool Mini or Not, because the owners of Cool Mini or Not actually own like three different plastic production shops in China. They also own their own, but everybody's not those two companies. We were all beating our head against the same wall, and ultimately it came down to when you're working with an overseas producer, you ask them, "Here's what we want to produce. Can you produce this?" And they'll say yes or no. They will never say no. They will always say, "Oh yes, oh yeah, yes, we can totally, yes, we can do that." Knowing full well they have no idea whether they can do
Yeah.
it. And so
That
you'll
sounds a
end up
theme
with
because and when I've talked to the novelists between Mike's early story of writing the Warrior Trilogy and Lauren's story of writing Double Blind, was that the yes is what you say no matter what, whether you know if you can do it or can't do it.
yeah, oh,
But
totally.
yeah.
So we get it. We understand. And actually, there's a whole lot of cultural stuff involved there. So, what's funny is that they think we want to hear yes, when in truth, we want to know a straight answer.
Yeah.
We're okay hearing no. No, we can't do that. No, for that, no, we can't do that. If you want it, because usually the follow-up to the no is, we can't do that because of this, this, and this. If we were to do it, it would be this. Here's what we
Correct.
have. In which case, we like, okay, we can totally work with that. Or, okay, yeah, that breaks our business model. We'll have to change some things.
Right.
And so that's something that culturally we're used to. In their cultures, they don't do that. That's not the way it happens. You just say yes, and then you ignore them forever if that's not actually something you can deliver. There's another thing where if you are producing a plastic production company for the gaming market, even if you have found somebody who can do it, this is the right company. They do the great product and pricing. Everything is great. Their priorities in production is whoever places the biggest order. If you're not giving them an order that's bigger than everybody else's, you're not at the front of the line. And when they finally work their way down to you, if somebody comes in and their order is bigger, they'll bump you and do it. And we've had times for BattleTech in plastics. We had times of, "Oh no, you're in front of line. We're your biggest priority. We're doing yours right now," for like 2 years. Never got it. Never got it produced. Couldn't do it. But we're always at the front of the line. Like, we're not really at the front of the line. We're not. We know we're not. Because if we were at the front of the line, we would have had it 4 months ago. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of nuances to that. And ultimately, things changed over the course of obviously the last 15 years. You had, Chinese, a massive amount of overseas producers go out of business trying to do stuff because they got stuck with the bills. And then as things recovered, it really does come down to the building of relationships. When you do have a company, a partner that you can work with to do stuff, the longer they work with you, the more they realize A, they can trust you, and B, you won't burn them. that karma makes a huge difference once you can get your foot in the door. And so for us, mostly it was Lauren and Randall working on trying to find the producers who could produce things. And at first it's like, okay, we need to find the cost and the nuance. This is probably way more down the rabbit hole than most people want to know,
but it's interesting. I love this. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool. So quite often you're like, okay, well now what's the cost of that? But the truth is there's no one right answer. There's the cost of production. There's the cost of molding, because creating the molds is expensive, as most people do not realize how expensive molds can be.
Well, like 5,000 per mini or something like that.
When we were first starting 15 years ago, it was 12 grand per mold.
Whew. Yeah.
And then you're like, well, but if we use a lesser metal, or if we use less time in the machine, or if we use them smaller, well, maybe we can squeeze two minis in the mold, like trying to find all these different ways to fiddle with it. And ultimately you realize molds are actually, for the producers, molds are expensive to make. They really are. And it is not a small mold. It's not like a little thing you can put in your pocket. No, these things are freaking like 25 pound blocks of a whole bunch of layers of stuff with aluminum and all. So there really is a lot involved. And part of that is that when you want something produced, you have to go through the learning process of realizing, oh crap, what I'm asking for actually is really complicated and expensive and hard.
Yeah.
So once we wrapped our heads around that and kind of found working relationships back and forth, then it comes down to how much do you need to pay when? So because the overseas manufacturers got stuck with so many bills so bad and so many of them went out of business, the ones that remained, they needed to protect themselves. And rightly so.
Yeah.
So what that means is that they would require more upfront to begin production, which makes sense. You know, you think, okay, I want a car. I'll just go down and buy a car. Well, that kind of assumes that you're going to get the car. But the truth is, if really what you're saying, I need you to build me a car, well, okay, that's a different deal, because there's a period of time for the turnaround. And there's a lot of things involved there. So anyway, usually a payment for production breaks down into three categories. How much is paid up front? And that'll get you to the product is produced. Then how much do you have to pay to get it released so they can get on a ship and sent to you? And then when are you required to pay what's left? And the idea is that you don't want to pay everything up front, because then they've got all the money. They have no reason to actually deliver anything for you. And you don't want to pay everything before you physically get your product into markets, because if there's quality control issues, you need to have something to provide leverage on. And it may not be that it changes what you just paid. You're paying through the nose, but it may be, okay, now I'm getting a 15% discount on the next print run to cover the cost you made me eat because you crapped out a whole bunch of garbage.
Right.
And we've all had that. You guys heard about the dice from the last Kickstarter.
Yeah.
So yeah, we, you know, perfect example of like, okay, everything we did was perfect. We paid everything up front and we got not what was expected. So, and that stuff's normal. So once you work out the math and find out everything that works, building the relationship long-term, this was kind of amazing. So I'll just tell you one of the lessons learned from that. You remember, like I said, my reign was get all these things, get the core stuff to market, the beginner box, Game of Armor Combat. And my pledge was, I will not say this is a success until we have this on store shelves without interruption, in stock on store shelves for 12 months straight. In the history of BattleTech, it had never happened. In the history of BattleTech, the core box sets were sold out 80% of the time. Even in FASA. They couldn't produce it fast enough. They couldn't get it in fast enough. They didn't know how many to order all the way back. It had never been on store shelves consecutively 12 months straight. And so I will say to this day, the success that BattleTech is seeing right now is built on the foundation of the fact that we built everybody's trust in us of, we will get you, keep this in stock. This will not go out of stock. In order to do that, in the first year, I think we had 3 print runs. Really wrap your head around that. That 3 full print runs in under 12 months. That is brutal. That from a production standpoint, the logistics involved, that's really, really hard to do. What we found by doing that for the first 2 years of keeping those two products in stock, and this was before we even got to the Clan Invasion Kickstarter,
right.
We proved to the company that was making our minis that we are not flaking. This is not a one shot. This is not a, we want you to order this and please send it to me and then we're done. This is, we want an ongoing relationship because we want reprints. We want you to keep this going. And over the course of that, by the time we got to the Kickstarter for the Clan Invasion, we had built a relationship with our classic producer, so much so that when other companies would falter on their turning over the deliverables and getting them into production, they're like, hey, one of our preferred clients just faltered. We now have 3 weeks. Do you want another print run? Yeah, you mean they let us bump the line. So we would just keep jumping the line every time somebody else would falter. We're like, great, here's another $300,000 order. You got it. And they realized they could come to rely on us because we always had a steady stream of things to reorder because we just could not keep this thing in stock. At the moment, it was, you know, we foreign releases, you know, all the international stuff, the growth. We now have a distribution house in Australia. Most people don't realize Australia is a massive hub for Battletech. Alpha Strike is so big in Australia. The fan base for Battletech is rabid in Australia, and it's awesome. Yeah. And so, you know, like, as we're expanding these things, like, we suddenly need to, you know, increase production by 25% on all these things that we haven't been able to keep in stock anyway. Like, our forecasting was originally intended to be, we were trying to stock for 18 months, and we would sell out in 10 to 15 days. That means you're now ordering a print run before you've been paid for any of the stuff you just sold.
Right.
And we would actually trip up quite often, not often, but a couple of times, we ended up having to pay for two print runs without getting the revenue of the first one before we went into the third. Just because it was being gobbled so bad. We have blown all the forecasts. No forecast for what the demand for Battletech would be have come even close to the actual fan base's demand for Battletech games. It's very clear that the fan base has been alive and thriving for Battletech. They just wanted a worthy product. The moment we started delivering worthy product to the fan base, it changed everything.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
So what else do you want to know?
I want to go back to Elementals.
Okay.
You know, it's fascinating kind of, you know, hearing kind of how the design kind of goes back to kind of how it prints, you know, not having a little blob and kind of the scale of that. I want to go in a little to the art and kind of ask, because one, there's one thing that bothers me, and I want to kind of back and forth on this. An elemental, not the battle armor, the elemental.
Just to be clear, you're talking about the elemental person inside.
The human, yes, the human.
Okay.
So people always say an elemental can be up to 8 feet tall. And for me, going back to my athletics, I doubt that. I don't believe that. I don't know if that's accurate. And I don't know if people in Battletech understand how big an 8 foot tall person is. And so one, I want to fact check that with you. Is that accurate? Because as an example, if people remember the movie Prometheus, when they when they woke up that engineer and the engineer is towering above them, that engineer is 7'1". And it makes everybody like Mass Effect Bender, who is not a small actor, look tiny. And so one, do elementals really get to 8 feet tall? And two, how are they, you know, they're fitting in the armor. It seems like their shoulders need to go farther out than a human shoulders would go in order to fit in. So I'm curious, this aspect that you talked about exactly how far arms go into a battle armor and how it works kind of under it. Two questions.
So you remember when I said my artist's primary objective above all other things is get me a really cool image.
Yep.
Okay. And that can trump things like realism and how the actuators work and all. Get me an amazing image first, and then we'll worry about the other things can kind of fall in order behind that.
Yeah.
In no uncertain terms, there's absolutely a degree of hand wave, especially if you look at some of those battle armor suits, like I think the Achilles. There's a few of those battle armors where you're like, okay, you can theoretically put a person in this, but there's no way they're going to fit. None of that stuff. Like, the dimensions are off.
Yeah.
Like, especially when you realize, like, the insides of the arms, the insides of the legs, the thickness is like this. I'm sorry, nobody's legs are that far apart. It doesn't work.
Right. Yeah,
and, you know, exactly. Same thing with shoulders. You get a lot of that. And yes, the proportions are functionally off. Totally. No doubt. Completely done just to make really cool looking images.
Cool.
That's absolutely true. for Battletech. In fact, a lot of those sketches, a part of that was the process. And most people don't realize, I don't want to say stingy. Let's go with thrifty. Just how thrifty the creative team was from Jordan, and then inherited by Lauren. Like, cost of stuff was really, really as lean as it could possibly be made. And quite often the question when I was freelancing was like, okay, so what's the cheapest we can get this for? And I'm like, I have always pushed back on, that's the wrong question to ask.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be shackled with this piece of crap that you got on as cheap as you could possibly do it for the next 4 decades, because like this stuff doesn't wear out. Come on, let's put some quality in. But anyway, it's come a long way. In the days of, like, you remember the first TROs, the early days of Battletech, honest to God, some of those sketches or some of the line work out of that was like a Sharpie on a napkin. Like, these things were not done well. And so they really were sketches. During the time when Jordan hired me to work on Mike Clicks, I've often joked, I worked there for just shy of 3 weeks. I never finished a single illustration, not one. I'd get like 80% done, like, yeah, that's great, good enough, I'll take it. And then literally the director would just snatch the illustration right out of off my desk and walk it right over to production. It's close enough, that's good enough. And so like the level of perfection and refinement, trust me, it never happened before now. Now we actually have a lot more of that, because not only are we designing them in-house with our team that has all the support, but they're then handed to Anthony's team, who builds them in 3D models and then does editing there once we can flip it all around. Like, oh yeah, that totally doesn't look right. Let's, it only looks good if you're looking at it from this one angle, but now we can actually look at it from all the angles and do stuff in 3D model, which is night and day different than we ever had access to back in the day.
Yeah.
But yes, to your, the core of your original question, can elementals really be 8 feet tall? Yes. In fact, that's a normal height for an elemental. Elementals can be just shy of 9 feet tall.
Interesting.
Now, that doesn't mean that they're perfectly scaled. As with all people can be bent, can be stretched, and like people come in, bodies come in all shapes and sizes. There's a lot of nuances in there. And so I would say a 9 foot tall elemental is a lanky elemental. Lanky being, he doesn't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger when he won Mr. Olympia. He still looks like an athletic person. But yeah, with the elementals in particular, this was a body type not possible outside of genetic tinkering. Like, we all know there's even body types that are like, you know, 1 in 10 million. You can have an, you know, athletics, the people that come out with just unbelievable proportion skills. Like, they're not all bodies are created equal. Yeah. There's a lot of range and changes and nuances in that. The worst elemental is better than the best physical example of humanity. They have been tweaked because of it. And they have a body type that's not even the amount of muscle mass that an elemental carries is not something that a normal human body can generate. It is completely artificial. So with those things in mind, yes, an elemental is dramatically different in scale. In fact, let me show you something real quick.
Yep.
So these are the Destiny scale figures that we did for that we revealed during MechCon. Okay. I'm sorry, during KerenskyCon. So here are the miniatures for 5'10" mech warriors.
Got it.
Here's the elemental in a suit.
Okay.
There's no perspective difference there. That is how dramatically different in size and scale they are.
Is that, did you measure that? Because that would be around the low sevens, my guess. But that one, that looks awesome, by the way.
This is probably high sevens.
Okay.
Of the person in suit.
Got it.
But yeah, so that's the scale difference between them, and you realize it kind of helps to reinforce that storytelling from you know, the battle where Shin Yudama's looking through his targeting optics going, you know, like, wow, what are those things coming at? And then he realized he's looking at a suit of battle armor because he was thinking he was looking at a mech.
Right.
Because they really are so much bigger than people. Like, this is not like the original art. We always thought, yeah, they're pretty close to infantry. No, they're not. They are so dramatically different than normal people. And it kind of helps bring everything to life in a way. I really look forward to the possibilities with the Destiny scale line of miniatures for the Battletech IP, because it gives you a chance. Like, when people actually have these two miniatures in their hands side by side and they realize, oh snap, okay, now I get a whole different sense of just how dramatically different an elemental is.
Yeah,
even outside of the suit, you know, take the suit away and that elemental is so much bigger, it's remarkable. And then you put the aerospace fighter pilot, and he or she is way shorter. It's dramatically different once they're in hand, scaled to each other, and the storytelling there is awesome. So,
but how do you get in and out of a suit of battle armor?
Have you not seen the art?
No, is it just open from the front? Is that what it is?
Yeah, the whole torso cockpit opens up.
Got it.
And we have if you Google elemental suits, you'll see a couple of illustrations where they are open. So yeah, I know that. I think I've done three different illustrations with people over the last 6-7 years, where it actually shows an elemental either in, you know, standing waist down with the suit opened up.
Got it.
Or with the suit open and the elementals outside of it next to it. So, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I remember seeing Eldon's cutaway too.
Yeah.
To that one. Question.
Yeah.
What elements of the Battletech universe appeal to you most as an artist?
Well, there's two answers to that. Number one, it's what elements appeal to me most, and then what elements appeal to me most as an artist. The element beyond no questions asked, the part of Battletech that appeals to me most is that it's very much like the movie Top Gun.
Okay.
It's the hero. It's the pilot in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. That's the hero. It's not the plane in Top Gun. The planes were not the heroes. The pilots were the heroes. And so for me, you know, like for Battletech MechWarrior, it's always been about the pilot in the cockpit. And part of that is you realize, you know, every battle mech has the power to level a city. The discipline involved, the decision-making involved of the people with their hands on the power and the triggers and stuff like that, that old samurai nuance of they can beat anybody, but should they? I think that right there is that wonderful dichotomy that makes it so inviting and interesting to me. As an artist, the chance to make mecha in so many shapes and designs that don't look just like a bigger human body. You know, you can make mecha in so many different ways and put a person in that cockpit and they are now functionally, you know, like they're driving a quad, they're driving a smaller unit, a fast unit, a slow unit, something that can jump over a building, like all that stuff. I think that as an artist, the sky's the limit on the number of things you can do with it. There's so many options to, like, you know, I have had the benefit of being able to design a ridiculous number of mechs in the IP. Before I became an official artist, I just hoped that one day I'd be able to design one mech that was actually canon.
Yeah.
And I've now lost count of how many units that I've designed that are canon. But it's when you're designing them, it's always so fun. You have so many pieces and things to play with to figure, you know, do I want a PPC? Do I want the lasers? Was it the Blood Reaper? Not the mech? Give me a second. There was a mech that was mentioned. Alaric Wolf took his trial in. And nobody had ever really talked about it. It was mentioned what weapons it had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Blood Reaper. It was mentioned how what weapons it had, but nobody said what it looked like. It was just commented. And so I'm like, okay, I love that that was just almost like a throwaway comment in a novel somewhere. Nobody ever had any plan for what to do with this. Like, okay, come up with the backstory. What did the engineers go through? What was the impetus that said we want to do something when we have all these other mechs involved? Why did they need this? What did it do? How did it fit in? There's cultural nuance. There's societal. There's logistics. There's all those things tied into these items that when some author makes an offhanded comment, I just want to grab it and fill in all the blanks, you know?
Yeah.
And I find that stuff really fun. I think that's so creatively engaging because it keeps your mind spinning at 3 a.m. when you can't sleep because you're like, oh man, that's so cool. I got to get up and write this stuff down. Awesome. I think that's part of it. It's just, yeah, it's inspiring.
What, from before your introduction professionally to BattleTech, was kind of your standout design? What is kind of like the iconic early BattleTech battle mech design for you?
Ooh. I don't know that you're going to like my answer.
I don't need to like it. I just want the truth. Don't just tell me yes. Okay.
So yeah, long before I ever heard of BattleTech, I saw a Marauder miniature in a game store, and I'm like, okay, I don't know what that is, but that's so freaking cool. I want that thing.
Awesome.
And I thought that was amazing. And then I, Robotech had what we call the Rifleman.
Yes. Okay.
And I fell in love with that. No idea what the weapons were, the capabilities, or anything. I'm like, okay, that just looks so cool. That looks so awesome. And I always imagined that his feet looked like it was wearing Converse All-Stars, you know, Chuck Taylors. And I'm like, oh man, a battle mech with Chuck Taylors, that's just badass. And so it's so funny. I to this day, I love the looks of the Rifleman. It is such an inherently bad mech, but oh man, I think it looks so cool.
Awesome.
And so as I was slowly getting into BattleTech, I saw the technical readout that had the Behemoth, the Stone Rhino on the cover.
Oh, yes.
And like, that's the coolest looking mecha I've ever seen. And honestly, even looking back, I'm like, that actually may be the best looking mecha of all time. It is so clunky and universally cool. Totally encapsulates the walking tank thing, but it looks like it's going like super fast, even when it's standing still. There's just something about the angles and the shapes and stuff. I'm like, oh man, that is badass. Once again, at the time, I had no idea what the weapons were.
I don't think Steve had an idea what the weapons were.
I'm pretty sure the record sheet designers didn't know what it was either, because it didn't ever match.
Yeah, that is a gorgeous cover. That might be my favorite TRO cover, other than 3057, the with the warship, the Leviathan, which I might be my favorite TRO cover. Man. It's such a beautiful
one. Cool. And
Bridges shared, I think 2 years ago on Twitter, he shared the original painting. That he did a JPEG of it, and I was able to kind of take that, upscale it, and that was without any of the iconography on it. So I sent it to Jaden Morris, who's done some work for me, and asked him if he could put the Ghost Bear logo on it the same way it appeared on the actual TRO. And and that kind of remastered from the original scan of the painting. It's such a beautiful image. I've shared it, you know, I think on Gallery 3025 at some point, but
that's fantastic.
But yeah, Venter's designs between kind of his the Timberwolf and that Mad Dog, kind of with that ground level perspective, so many.
Yeah.
And I like his elemental design. I love his elemental battle armor design. But yeah, he might be my favorite, you know, in terms of the BattleTech mech designers.
What else do you want to know?
From the old art, you know. There's cover art has taken a big evolution over time. And I wanted to ask about that too. You know, a lot of the, you know, especially for you having just said that BattleTech is Top Gun for you and it's kind of the pilot centric, but the covers have deviated from that. The covers are the fighter planes these days. Whereas a lot of the old covers are like, if you look at the Warrior trilogy, you know, you have Catherine on one, and then you have, I don't even remember off the top, but you have, Ulrich Kerensky on another. And so all those kind of like Jim Holloway, Boris Vallejo kind of artwork, and it's kind of gone to more just mechs on battlefield. What's inspired, what's behind that evolution? Do you guys have any kind of nostalgic look back and we'll kind of want to bring some characters back into that cover art? You know, what, give me a little bit of history and the mindset behind that, that choice.
Sure. So it's interesting. There's there's a lot of nostalgic love, especially for those old covers that have the characters and the composition, almost like a Star Wars poster kind of thing, where there were different elements and all kind of floating out there. One of the difficult things is that while that is has a strong nostalgia sense to it, it also can make your product look dated really fast. As soon as hairstyles change or fashion styles change, that gets dated. You look at something from the 90s, you look at something from the 80s, you look at something from the early 2000s, and you can spot it, and you're like, I'm sorry, that's it looks like that. And one of the nuances with overhauling the line is making it relevant to a modern market, realizing the modern market is going to have to stay new for easily 15 years. So that makes putting characters on things problematic. That was part one. Part two, it comes down to what's the storytelling you're trying to tell. Is the storytelling about the character? Is the storytelling about the events? You should see some of the art notes that we would get from the creative teams. And you're like, I can't put that in. Even if I had a $10,000 budget per image, I couldn't put all that amount of detail into a single image. That's insane. What we have kind of come to embrace is that we need products. We need covers that match the need for the way the product will be displayed on store shelves. So if it's a novel, people will come to the, if you're looking at a shelf full of novels, people will interact with that at roughly arm's length. And then they'll pick it up and they'll bring it closer and they'll look closer. So there's an amount of detail that you can work with on a novel cover that's kind of at odds with the fact that you've actually got a tiny little amount of real estate to work with. So you want to make sure that your image is so cool that it will stop someone in their tracks, make them grab it and look at it closer. The composition for what it will be on a novel is dramatically different than what it will be if it's a box set on a store shelf, because people will look in a, will walk through a game store and they will stand 10 to 15 feet away from a store shelf as they scan through. And you have to design the image to grab their attention and make them want to walk forward, grab that box, and look at what's on the back. And so you will find that the next time you go into a game store, try it. Actually, like walk through or Barnes & Noble or something. Like stand back, do that hard, that you know, that thing where humans do when they're looking across a group looking for their one friend.
Yeah,
like that soft pan that you do. That's what everybody does when they walk into a store and like, I'm not sure what I want. I'm going to just scan across these bookshelves. I then realize which images jump out to you, which ones catch your attention. And then of those, which ones catch your attention enough to make you want to reach out and grab it and pick it up. So we actually did, over the course of several years at Gen Con, we would face products out at the crowd, not toward the store, but out toward the crowd. And we would pick different ones that were different compositions to see which ones stop people in the crowd. Like literally, they'll stop traffic. People will bang up behind them because they're suddenly stopped like, oh, what is that? That's so cool. I got to get it. And they will reach out and grab it. And so it literally came down to the litmus test was what will make people stop in their tracks to pick it up. And the nuances between that answer depend entirely on what is in the product. Is it a box set? Is it a tabletop game? Is it a little thing? Is it a novel? Like all those nuances, they're unique. So when we were tasked with redoing all the novels for the MechWarrior Dark Age novel series, 30 novels in the series, we wanted them to look identifiably different. We wanted them to capture people's attention, but we also wanted them to kind of fit within the novel line. And so on all of those, you'll see that there is a character portrait up in a corner, like the face hovering over the sky. Yep. And then for the most part, a single neck doing something with a relatively simple background. Remember I said it's always about the pilot in the cockpit. Now that I'm pointing this out to you, you're going to recognize it. Almost every single cockpit that you'll see on a cover image from us, now, you can see into the cockpit. You can actually see that there's somebody in there at the controls. It used to be there'd just be like a shiny color, or it's all dark, you can't see in there. I'm like, no, in order for us to really bring the fact that the focus is on the mech warrior in the cockpit, we have to be able to see into that cockpit to some degree. There has to be a hint of what's going in there. So when you look through now the images that are your favorite of since we redid the line,
Yeah.
start paying attention to which cockpits you can see into. And I think you'll find that in almost every one of them there, you can look right in. Especially any image done by Anthony, you can look right in, you can see that the person at the control is doing something. You know
Yeah.
there's a pilot in there.
Awesome.
So yeah, so that's part of it.
What's one that stands out as kind of a best kind of
Oh,
sample? And
one of the
I'll
very first
overlay
ones
it
we
here.
did was Combat Manual Karita
The Wolverine. That is a great
with the
one.
Wolverine on it, and you can look and you can almost see the expression on that pilot's face, and it's awesome, and it brings all that drama right through to you. So that was actually the one we like use. This is the litmus test. We want like this on everything.
Awesome.
But with that said, there's also a different nuance with covers you probably would not expect. Covers before we did we redid the line. We built 3D models for everything. We redesigned everything. Before that, a cover was a 3 month deadline. If I gave somebody 2 months, that was a short tight deadline for a cover. And it was $2,000 or above for the cover. Because we now have 3D models, the mechs have been redesigned. The artist does not have to spend 60% of their time measuring, figuring out the vanishing points and the lighting, how does the shadowing go. We have made the process go so much faster. I'm not kidding. I gave in the last year alone, I have probably given 6 to 8 novel cover assignments with deadlines shorter than 2 weeks. I'm getting covers in 8 days because the 3D models make things so much faster. And so part of the answer to the question of why the covers now look different is because we are being asked to do so many more covers, but my artists are able to do them so much faster than we were able to do before because we have the 3D models for the mechs. We do not have 3D models for all the characters. We don't have a line full of Destiny scale figures already 3D modeled. We don't have that. We don't have any of the infantry done. So we're intentionally using those sparingly because we get more bang for the buck out of an image by draw. I can give an artist 15 mechs in a complex battle scene. They can drop it all into 3D. They can get it all like figured out where they want to place everything, set the lighting, set the camera angle, and in 3 days he'll have the proof to me. That was never possible before. So it's easier, faster, and cheaper for us to do mech scenes than it is to do scenes with characters in them. In
Interesting.
fact, quite often, my best mech artists, not really good at drawing people.
Yeah,
They
that
don't need
was
to be
kind of
good
where
at
I was
drawing
going.
people. Yeah, it's a totally different skill set. The organics are totally different. Like, we don't have 3D models for that. So, and then there's a whole lot of problematic fact check stuff with people. Okay, what? Literally down to what are the seams on the uniform? What are the patches? Okay, oh no, that unit got the custom patch because it was at this point they did the breakaway from this, and they're like all that stuff comes in when you actually start dealing with characters, people, that kind of stuff. It bogs down so much. It is one of the hardest parts of dealing with art for BattleTech is when you get people because all those nuances of like, oh, were they the FedCom at this point? Did they break away? Okay, they hadn't broken away yet, but they'd gone back to the Steiner uniforms, but the badging still matched over here. And oh no, this one got a different unit patch at this point. And that stuff, like, there's nothing more frustrating than you get everything done, you get it all off, turned over to layout. Layout's getting ready to send the print files, and some fact checker says, oh no, we got the wrong patch on this. It's supposed to be a different color. Freaking kidding me. So that just that the nuance of that kind of you play to your strengths and you double down on it.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know. I feel like that's not as boring. It's like I always use the Tales of the Black Widow cover as an example because there's
Oh.
nothing in that background that is BattleTech, but it's still an amazing cover. And so at some point you gotta, you do your hand wave him and roll it cool with that as well. But as a fan, I would love to see the combination. The covers that stand out for me are like the Way of the Clans, you know, with the direwolf in the background. And there's still, when you look at that, obviously the direwolf catches you, but the feeling comes from the that sense of imminent danger that the soldier is as he's kind of hiding behind, or a cover like you know, Blood of Heroes, you know, with the Hatchet Man kind of looming and the characters there by Vallejo. Mm. So I would love to see kind of return. I do, you know, I understand kind of the logistical value of kind of the mechs and the 3D models, but I do, you know, as kind of a customer feedback, it becomes monotonous. It's like, oh, here's a different mech and a different pose and different shooting. So I encourage you as a fan and a big fan of the art to kind of, you know, man, if you can find someone that has the equal talent of mech and character, that would be great to see more of it again.
Well, and we have him, like, you know, Anthony, one of the best character, probably the best character artist of all time that's ever worked on it. Mm-hmm. We need to be overhauling the 3D models.
Yeah.
People
who are good at something are usually good at multiple things. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love one of Anthony's on his DeviantArt. He has a great picture, a Star Wars picture of a B-Wing and a bunch of kind of characters running around the B-Wing. That's a great piece that he's done. But yeah. Well, you guys need to stop giving him work, so maybe I can commission a piece from anything.
Yeah, it will never happen. We've got him booked out so far. We just tell him, don't look at it. Just trust us. There's the next thing you need to work on.
Which does lead me in a question kind of that I wanted to throw at you, because I have been kind of trying to kind of commission some pieces and track down artists outside of the kind of the BattleTech, microcosm there and try to see what other kind of concept artists might do. Way harder in practice than it was in my original idea, because those people are as busy as an Anthony Scroggins is. But a question did come up the other day that one of the artists was concerned if he was getting paid a commission to do a BattleTech piece, if there was a legal conflict in there. My understanding was it was only a legal conflict if we took that piece and then tried to sell it commercially. Can you confirm? Like, is there any conflict for me?
Yeah, anybody who wants to take a private commission, that's totally fine. That doesn't compete with the business model that Topps needs to protect.
Awesome.
The moment somebody says, "Yeah, I want to put this up for sale on Etsy," okay, well now you just totally blew it. You know, that's totally that's not okay. One of the things that's interesting, our existing artists. We had 8 years ago-ish, Topps rewrote the contracts because they realized they had a whole bunch of verbiage that was really old that they kind of inherited over previous incarnations of BattleTech and stuff. Like, okay, so when we rewrote that contract, I was allowed to add in a couple of clauses to grant our artists the chance to do things like sell prints of their own work at personal appearances. So that when an artist goes to a show and like, yeah, here's the illustrations I did for BattleTech, they can have prints of posters and they can sell them and sign them. Awesome. Because that's part of the experience. And like when you're a fan, you want to go to a convention, man, you imagine going to see Doug Chafee or Franz Bowlinkle, you know, Klaus Schwerwinski at a show. Like, that's so cool. Met him, shook his hand, bought a poster, he signed it for me. I'm going to go home and frame that. That's part of that whole enhanced experience that you get at a convention.
Yeah.
Legally, none of that existed before I had the contracts written. And in truth, the artist did not have any rights to their art at all to do anything with them. I'm like, okay, no. We want them to have that. We want them to be able to, like if they do the collected works of Klaus Schwerwinski, the collected works of Franz Bowlinkle, by all means, Franz, go ahead and put together a book of your work to promote yourself. We've got you covered. No problem. Just include the little legal fine print that this is actually owned by Topps and used with permission, and we're good to go. One of the nice things is that in all legal, contracts is, unless given express written permission, and that's always the clause in every contract, given express written permission. One of the nice things is that I'm the one that gives express written permission. So, when my artist asked me, "Hey, can I, I'm putting in a submission for Spectrum FM or XM, I'm doing something for the new, up for a major award at this other thing. Imagine FX wants to do a spotlight on me. Can I use my image?" Yes, I can actually give them express written permission just right on the spot. I don't have to send it to anybody. No lawyer needs to review it. We got this covered. We've done this enough. We know exactly how to do this. So it's actually kind of nice because I've added in those clauses so the artists actually have some limited rights to their own stuff, particular to promote themselves and to promote us. And then for me to give them, grant them those weird exceptions where some special convention in Indiana wants me to do this thing, Yeah, cool. Totally, go for it. But yeah, every artist has the ability to do a fan commission.
Awesome.
It just needs to stay just the fan commission. They can't turn that into, yeah, now I'm going to go put this for sale on DeviantArt or something. Like, you can show it on DeviantArt. You can give it away. Let everybody share it and use it in their games. And, you know, this is, you know, you want to use this character in as your RPG character, do it. Give it away. The moment you charge $1 for it, all the rules change. So that's the way it works.
Yeah, and that's what I started with. I don't know if you're familiar with Gallery 3025, but it's basically just a way for us to commission artists, and then whatever they produce is free for people in the Battletech community to use.
Which is a good way to go.
Yeah, definitely. Next question, maps. I would love to hear the development process for maps. You know, the battle maps that you guys have been producing, I absolutely love. You know, from what Lauren was saying, I'm not the only one. And so I'd love to kind of hear a little bit about the process. Not so much just the art and production, but the play testing and kind of designing the map, and, you know, how to know what level to put here and what obstacle to put here. What is that process?
So do you have a secret desire to be designing maps? Is this what I'm hearing?
I'd love to kind of hop in, you know, and help out where I can. But okay. I can't say I get to play tabletop a lot, you know, and we have a baby due in about 10 days. So it might be a little crazy.
You see, this is... It's always like, you gotta be careful what you ask for, because you just might get it.
I mean, yes. Okay. Yeah, we talked about it earlier, right? Yes, definitely. I can do that, and I'm very good at it.
And yeah, there'll be no problem whatsoever.
And I can produce it in half the time as anybody else on your team.
Exactly. Yeah, so it was funny. One of the things when I took over as line developer, I was committed to make sure that Catalyst was producing everything that the fans needed to play. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that was maps. You know, I fought behind closed doors so hard. I'm like, we have to produce maps. No, we can't do maps. Maps are big. Maps are expensive. You know, maps don't shelve well. There's no spines for art. There's no, like, we don't want to be like, we don't even know how, we don't even have artists for that. I'm like, I will invent artists for this. I will find a way. So I looked far and wide. I was actually probably on the lookout for a good map artist for more than 4 years. And I found several artists that do maps within a gaming space, but they are so in demand. The rate that they needed to charge was astronomical, because our maps are huge. And I didn't want one Battletech map. I'm like, no, I want a 4-foot by 6-foot. Like the BFMs that we produce now.
Yeah.
That was my, like, I want big, giant cover the table maps. I want maps. I want battlefields. I want to run amok. And so, yeah, there were lots of hurdles involved with that. So once I finally came across Kat Welder, which we gave her a lot of attention. It was incredibly well-earned during the first Kickstarter, you know, that this lady is amazing. She is a Battletech fan. She knows the IP. She loves the universe. And she just happens to be an incredibly good Battletech or map designer. But just to be clear, map artist. She hadn't actually designed any maps, and by design, I mean, I'll show you. Designs aren't pretty.
That's what,
like, they're like really,
it. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are leader from the upcoming map set. There's Kat right now is working on this map set. This is the lunar set.
Okay.
We have 6 maps that will all fit together in this lunar set that are a drop ship that broke up in atmosphere and crashed.
Okay.
So yeah, so they look really, really rough. This is what the shorthand looks like on map designs. As far as art and bringing them to life, Kat was amazing. So I put together, I sent out to the fan base, to the developers, to the just social media, everybody far and wide, the demo agents, the CamoSpecs team. I reached out to everybody. I said, hey, look, I'm putting together a map design team. Anybody that wants in can come in. Come on. And I think we have 16 people join in on the map design team. And what we very quickly learned is that a lot of people can design 1 or 2 maps. Not a lot of people can design a lot of maps. And most people don't have the artistic skill to say that's a cool looking map. most people's maps come out looking very geometric. They're symmetrical. They don't look organic at all.
Right.
It's actually tough to wrap the head around of, okay, we need to do an organic looking environment, but make it work on a 3D hex grid. Mm-hmm. That's not an easy thing. Most people have a real, at some point, they start making it look like key notches. Yeah, and it's tough to get it to work. It's especially tough to do it. Randall pointed out, I think by the beginning of this year, we had produced 49 new map designs. New maps. Once again, you start doing 50 of anything, and it's really hard to come up with 50 unique ideas.
Yeah.
That breaks down in quantity. And I knew all along that this needed to be an ongoing line of map products, and every one of these products had to have multiple maps in it. So this was a big deal. And over the course of things, it just came down to there are very few of us that are good at designing maps, and there are also very few of us that are good at illustrating maps. Kat was a singular, brilliant, creative mind. She was so incredibly good. But one of the things that Kat and I did early on is, as I said, it's going to be hard to find someone to back you up because we can't use just one artist for everything. That's going to be awful. So we built the tutorial of here's how we do build maps. Here's how we build map files. Here's how to illustrate a map. Not how to design a map, but how to illustrate a map. So she actually wrote a full tutorial for it. I paid her for it, and it's available. I will happily send you this tutorial. Here's how to create a map. None of that has anything to do with playtest, but that's how to actually create the visual for the design. Now, with my team of volunteers for the map design team, what we did is when I did the, I think we started out with the two maps for the beginner box. I'm sorry, three maps for the beginner box and the Game of Armor Combat, and then the 12 maps that were in the Grasslands set.
Okay.
So total, there was 15 maps in the initial effort. We did a lot of playtesting with that. In fact, a lot of the map team would build it in Megamech, and they would run simulations, a whole bunch of simulations, and to see what the patterns were.
Yeah.
And very quickly, you learn there's some things like you need to make sure that you don't go putting, you know, heavy woods in 5 or 6 hex patterns across the battlefield. Because somebody with a jump of 5 or 6 you'll never hit them. They can just jump around the battlefield. You'll never be able to shoot them. You can't. Their defense modifier will be too high. It's game breaking. Try to avoid having a 1 or 2 superior hexes on the field. Where you know what, just get yourself to this one hex and turtle there for the entire game and don't do anything. That's not fun. That doesn't make good gameplay or a good fun experience. Even though that's the smart thing to do, that doesn't mean the smart thing to do is fun to play. So we did a whole lot of playtesting originally. And honestly, with the first, I would say the first 30 map designs, we did thorough playtesting. After that, we started burning out playtesters and map designers. Most of the map design team bowed out. And we were left with roughly 3 or 4 volunteers who were actually pretty good. Not spectacular, but pretty good. And then me. And I would always, I would do all the punching of stuff, and ultimately I would run things by either Ray or Randall or both. And we would play test it. And ultimately we got really good at visually figuring out what those nuances were without having to play test it. So I don't have to play test things now. I look at it, I can figure out, okay, your set spacing, if you want these things, that's fine. Just put them close enough together so that the defensive modifiers don't get too far. One of the biggest things we did is finding a way to make water playable. On all of those old classic maps, most people were so repelled by water that they refused to play on a board with water. And the reason is because there were so many problems with getting it. You can't run a map through water. As soon as you step into it, you have to make a roll. What if it's got the legs taking damage? Now it's flooding. You fall on down rolls. All that other stuff. It ends up just ending up with not a good gameplay experience.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, it makes sense to have water in environments to make them believable environments to play in. And so one of the things I realized was that there's something called depth zero water.
Yeah.
And it's basically water that's 6 feet or less deep.
Right.
which if you're a tank or an infantry person, yeah, you have to, that's an obstacle. But for a battle mech, that's like stepping in a puddle. It has nothing. It does nothing. So it actually has no impact on battle mech gameplay. Battle mechs can run right through that.
Right.
They have no problem with that. So, you know, once I had some maps that I thought would work with it, I did the design, I pitched them to Ray and Randall. We all talked about it. We worked through it. We did the play test. And we're like, you know what? Let's do this. So we have widely embraced the selective use of Depth Zero Water. There are a whole lot of old maps that would be amazing if they had just been made more playable with Depth Zero Water in some in select areas. Not everywhere, but in places that open up those gameplay decisions of, you know, choosing, do I want to risk going this way? Do I want to risk going that way? You know, like that kind of stuff. It ended up with just dramatically increasing the enjoyment of playing on those map environments. That ended up being a huge thing. So now you'll see as we continue to redo old maps, there's an upcoming map set called Savannahs. And every one of those is a classic map. And several of those we brought in that were maps that had water, and all I did was selectively make some of those water hexes Depth Zero. It totally changed them. Now they're completely playable. They're actually a lot of fun. It makes things a lot more interesting and stuff. So you'll see that. Awesome. One of the other things we did, which was kind of crazy, it was for Toucaid. We started it on Toucaid. In Battletech, where we have a rule for everything already, it's not like people look at Battletech like, yeah, they need more rules for stuff. It doesn't happen. But when it came to Toucaid, we're like, okay, we need to actually add new rules for stuff because some of these are really weird. For instance, we had a massive forest that was set on fire. It's an active forest fire map. How do you play that? You got to have rules for it. So we actually created specific rules for that, included in on each one, for Robin's Crossing in particular. Robin's Crossing was this entire front of a war where the Jade Falcons were bottled up because they could not get across this river. Anybody that got anywhere near this river died. There was no way to not die. And ultimately what they did is they realized, okay, there's one spot at one part of the river where if we sink five mechs in and build ourselves a little wall, then we can jump use that as a skipping spot to jump across the river. So we actually found a way to build that. And part of that was finding, we need hexes that you can't occupy. If you try to go in this hex, it'll kill you. The hex will kill you. You can't go there. Don't even try to go there. The only exception would be battle armor, and they have these ridiculous rolls to make. But it put the decision, the choice, in the hands of the player. If the player has a reason, you know what? I can do it. I take a risk. But if I've got a reason to do it, oh man, it gives me these other options. And that is that wonderful thing of when players like, I know what the smart thing to do is, but what I want to do is this. And giving them the opportunity to do that, that's actually been something that's been really cool. So yeah, creating new rules, creating maps that reinforce the storyline that we're trying to tell. One of the things that you may have seen at Adepticon, we had decision at the Thunder Rift map. There's a battle map coming up. It's the first of what we're calling the Legendary Battles line.
Okay.
And a battle mat is two maps large. It's double sized. Yep. I went through, you know, we had this idea like, oh, this would be really cool. Let's do this. What if we could do the Thunder Rift? Okay, let me really think about that. So I went through the novel, and actually I'm really impressed. In hindsight, I never knew this was a thing when I was a fan reading it just for the enjoyment of reading a good story. But Bill did an amazing job of talking about how far apart each one of these things were, because as they're going through Thunder Rift, it's a series of ambush sites. And as soon as their position gets overrun, they fall back to the next ambush site. Bill actually comments how far apart those were.
Perfect.
I was able to map out Thunder Rift and get it to fit on a battle mat. And it, like, literally to the hexes, like, the counting the hexes on how far they were, it all worked. I couldn't believe it. Yeah, but the thing is, the Thunder Rift, you're fighting your way uphill the whole way. From the base of where you're going up to the entrance to Thunder Rift, and this was all in the fiction. Bill had laid this all out.
Yeah.
To the point where they're fighting in front of the rift hole. It is 21 levels that you have to go up. That's not counting the walls. That's the ground. You are going up 21 levels. So you just imagine running your mech up 21 levels. So we actually played it at Adepticon. And it was the first time we played it. Like, oh, man, I hope this works the way it's supposed to. We're on film. Like, we're broadcasting. There's no going back, man.
Yeah.
But it worked exactly the way it played out in the novel. Like, literally, the small beleaguered band could hold off dramatically superior forces, and they would overheat. Like, everything worked in exactly the way it was, just because Bill had really done a good job of figuring out how all that would work. So yeah, so there's that, and then the other side of that map is going to be the Battle of Misery. So yeah, it's going to be really, really cool. I think when people see them, they're going to be blown away. They're just really, really fun, very cool places.
Awesome.
Yeah.
The you know, are there products that you're especially excited about coming up that we haven't seen before? Other than maybe those Destiny miniatures, those look pretty
amazing. There are so many. Yeah, the Destiny miniatures, that's still, we're still figuring out exactly how that's all going to look when all is said and done. Yeah, I am looking forward to the legendary battles. Yeah, I think that's just such a unique thing. Really kind of running with what we did on 2K and keeping that going. What else? I am spectacularly excited to finally see the Star Slayer mini come out. That's, in my opinion, I think that is one of the best mechs for Mercenary.
Okay.
Because in universe, if you think about it, they don't have to pay for much ammunition. If they're cut off or they have to run for their lives or whatever, they still got their two main guns. They still have decent movement. They have jump ability. It's not, it is a jack of all trades. It's not super good at anything, which frankly is actually quite good for a mercenary. But it all comes down to, man, when I was playing Mech Commander 2, and you finally get that chance to salvage the Star Slayer, I'm like, oh, I finally have a good mech that I can use instead of running around with the junk. So, yeah, funny little things like that. Let's see, what else? I have been spectacularly excited to see the Alpha Strike box go out to market. That was a pipe dream for so long. So honestly, seeing the Clan Invasion box, like, it's in the rearview mirror, so people, like, you know, maybe some of the nostalgia sheen has come off of it, but that box was 15 years in the making, something like that. Like, that thing was originally pitched and solicited to market without ever even having a chance of coming out. Like, that thing was it was the unicorn. The Clan Invasion box set was the unicorn. So we actually pulled that one off. There is a book that is going into print very soon. I expect it to release right around October, November, the Universe book. It was actually something that we were actually just recently talking about this on one of the broadcasts during the last the Clan Invasion Kickstarter. As that was running amok, and Lauren was saying, you know, like, okay, I know none of us have any sleep, but come up, give me everything, anything we can add as a stretch goal. And we were just like, every product that we had, like, we're trying to get approved, and it wasn't getting approved for so long. We just throw it out to Lauren. He's like, okay, fine, put that out. We'll commit to it. We were committing to so many things that we had no idea how to actually get across the finish line, but we're doing it. And one of the coolest ones was this Universe book idea. And it went out. We promised, we committed to do it. We actually, my art team, finished all of the work on the Universe book 1 year and 9 months ago.
Okay.
I've long since been done with this book.
Yeah.
Except that I'm now about to send like 9 more illustrations out to Eldon to do, because Randall had this wild idea. It's like, oh man, let's add this. So I'm like, okay, that sounds really freaking cool. I'll do it. No problem. We'll get it. But yeah, so when the Universe book comes out, honestly, I think all of the existing fans, when they get it, they're going to love it. I think this is such a cool, this is the BattleTech universe. And brand new people to the franchise that have never heard about BattleTech are going to see this and like, oh man, this is the coolest thing. It is going to be like, you want to dive down the rabbit hole and fall all the way in and fall in love with BattleTech. This book will get you no matter what your hook is, whether it's RPGs or tabletops or minis or whatever it is. This Universe book is going to be the gateway drug for anybody that's remotely interested in BattleTech. So, yeah, I think the Universe book is going to be just really, really cool when everybody gets hands on.
That sounds amazing. I can't wait.
Yeah.
What's how do you decide what minis to put in each box?
It's entertaining. There's a lot of swearing.
Okay. A lot of campaigning.
So he,
a lot
yeah,
of,
so he,
a lot of
oh,
bribery.
Oh, you have no idea.
A lot of bribery.
Oh God, yeah. It's hysterical if people actually really saw behind closed doors how the sausage is made. Usually what it comes down to is like there is a hook that we're trying, like this particular product is a this. You know, like the Wolf Dragoons pack when we did that. Like, okay, so we're gonna have to, you know, choose some exit. But ultimately it comes down to we have the idea for something, we're like, okay, we think this will be cool. And then it comes down to Ray, Randall, and I putting our heads together and choosing the mechs. And the way that works is usually I will cut mine everything because they're both too busy. And as soon as I get the idea, I can't sleep. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm like, okay, fine. I'm just going to get up and work on it. So I'll get up and I'll go mine every single thing. Like, okay, if the category, so for instance, Klein Invasion Era. All right. I will go mine every single canon unit that's Klein Invasion Era, and I'll put it all on the spreadsheet. And then I'll start off by that. Okay, now let's take out all the ones we've already done. Let's pull those off. What do we got left? Okay, now let's identify any ones that clearly need to be, like, you know what, that's really a Civil War era one, like Sagittarius. You know what, Sagittarius is Civil War. Let's push that one off. Like, me pulling units aside so that you know they are automatically going to be signature units for something else. So, for instance, the Hatamoto Chi. I have wanted a Hatamoto Chi for 2.5 years. I love the Hatamoto Chi. I want the Vibro Sword. Like, this is such a friggin' cool, awesome, like, iconic Battletech mech. But it's so signature House Karita that that's got to be the House Karita box set. So, okay, so let's pull that one off and put that in. So we do that. So what you're left with is a list of 5 times more mechs than you can possibly fit into whatever the product is. Mm-hmm. After you've pulled everything aside. And then I will send an email out to Randall and Ray. It's like, okay, here's the link to the spreadsheet. I've already marked mine, and we'll do a column for Randall, a column for Ray, and a column for me, and I'll put X's on all the ones that I think are the ones that should be, and Ray will go through and he'll put X's on all the ones that don't match with anything that I like because we like completely opposite things. And then Randall will come in and he'll do like half of the ones that Ray likes, half the ones that I like, maybe one or the two ones that need one, or it's like, dude, what are you thinking? And then we're like, all right, well, we've all put in the work, now let's all get together, and then we argue about which ones are which. We're like, okay, who cares the most, who cares the least, like, who, let's make our pick, and it literally is a box all to see who gets what, when, where, and why. And the disqualifiers can be for any number of reasons, from this needs to be in this product to this one, you know what, we actually have plans for an experimental version of this one in an upcoming PDF. Okay, we'll do that. You know what, this actually becomes a higher priority even though none of us were thinking of it because of this reason, and it's always darn good reason, so we can't ignore it. And you're like, that's how the sausage is made. When all is said and done, we end up with a list. And sometimes we can't par it down. We still end up with too many units. At that point, we will usually reach out to Anthony and say, you get to be the tiebreaker. And he'll throw in additional units that none of us had chosen. And usually two of his will get in because he's got really good reasons for it. Makes a good case, and something will run amok, and something will get spun up into two more products that things get used about. Like, oh, that's a great idea. You know what? Phil Lee was just talking about doing this for this other product. Or what if we move that over here and make this a thing? And it happens. It's just, it all spirals out of control in a wonderful snowball effect. And when all is said and done, sometimes I'm surprised. I don't remember that being in that box set. Wow. Okay. So that's in this. Okay. And then we all show up at Gen Con, and they will unload 200 cases out of the truck and set them in the middle of the booth. I'm like, all right, and I'll put them on the shelves. And we're like, what? And so we're cracking open boxes and we're like, I know we're the ones that made this. I don't remember any of these units. Who put these in this box? Like, it's a really good idea. It worked out well, but I don't remember doing this at all because we're all way too sleep deprived. And anyway, then we'll just put it all on the shelves and we'll stand back and look at this wall, you know, like these walls of box sets of minis, and be like, man, it actually worked. I can't believe that. But we still don't have the Hatamoto Chi. And what's the one that you're looking for? And we continue to argue behind closed doors about which ones need to go in the next set. And that's how we end up with a second follow-up Kickstarter.
Well, it looks like we're getting a Hatamoto Chi in the Somerset Strikers box. So
I'm telling you.
So, on its way.
Yeah. Yeah, I still don't think we have the solitaire. I think we gave, because Lauren's two favorite mechs are the solitaire and the Sagittaire.
Okay.
And we gave him the Sagittaire, but I don't think we have a solitaire yet. So he's still chipping away at us to get it. And we haven't worked our way through the point where that needs to come in yet. But plus, it's also fun to mess with him and just, you know.
Always.
Yeah.
You mentioned Curie to box set. Tell me more about that. Are you having faction box sets coming up?
We absolutely want to have faction box sets. When we started doing the new box line, the lines of sets, the lines of alliance packs and stuff, obviously we started off with, let's start off with all of the ones that are universal that every faction has, because those are the ones that most of the players are going to need to get on their tabletop battlefields.
Right. Right.
And then we're like, okay, now the truth is that's several procs, because there's a lot of those. There's a whole lot of mechs in battle. And then we're like, all right, well, got to add in the clans. And then we had to add in the second line and the Inner Sphere reaction, you know, like all the ones the Inner Sphere designed to fight the clans after the clans invaded. So that was a thing. Then we move forward into, you know, functionally the next era. Not necessarily because we wanted to go era by era by era, but it's just kind of like there was such a massive glut of designs in universe that were created over a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And really quality designs that were incredibly playable that fans were going to, you know and love and can't wait to get their hands on. So that's all good. Once you get that universal baseline of basically the units that most everybody had access to in some way, shape, or form, even the clan mechs, you know, like the clan invasion happened and so many people were getting battlefield salvage that a lot of those mechs percolated into other armies. So it's not like that, like that mech was only a clan wolf mech. No, that's not true. The clans traded them all back and forth between each other. They won and lost some from battlefield salvage between each other. And then they came to the Inner Sphere, and the Inner Sphere fought and captured them and got all that stuff. So there was a lot of integration of designs. But now that we, you know, with this, when we got into the Kickstarter for mercenaries, we're like, all right, now we can start getting into designs that percolated a lot farther, a lot more unique ones, you know, mm-hmm. things that no one would consider a frontline unit or, you know, whatnot. Now that we'll get that out of the pipe, then we can start. If you start looking at the mechs that we haven't done yet, you'll realize a lot of them are faction specific.
Okay.
They're fan loved ones, but they're faction specific. Yeah. So they kind of, it totally makes sense kind of organically as we continue to chip away through to do ones that are, you know, unit specific to a faction. And every major house has them. Comstar has them. We already did the Comstar ones though, to get those out of the way. Cause it made sense with the clan invasion stuff. But yeah, there's, I think the further down the rabbit hole we go, the further through the eras we can go, because you have factions are where we go. But then you also, once you get the faction packs, then we'll start moving through some of those dark later era items. Cause you look at the designs from the Civil War, and then you look at the designs from the Dark Age, dramatically different in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
The technology that was in them was different. The production things, even designs, like there was a spider before the Dark Age and a spider after the Dark Age, but those two spiders are not the same. And that you can say that about a lot of the designs. So as we work our way through the eras and stuff, obviously in Battletech lore, we are right now beyond the Dark Age era. We are into the Ilkhan mm-hmm. era. And that will have a whole new era of new designs and stuff that we need to do. And we're a long way away from getting there. But I think that what we'll do is we'll start picking units that, picking box retailer appropriate boxed products, from a variety of eras instead of like working our way through the eras from back to front. Just because if all of our novels and the source books and stuff are Ilkhan era, but all the miniatures are from two eras behind, that's not going to do retailers any good. We want to make sure that everything we design is retailer friendly. We don't ever want to generate any content that retailers pick up and it sits on their shelf for a year and a half and doesn't move.
Right.
So there's always that nuance of making sure that, you know, we stick to the guns of when we overhauled the line, it was specifically to make it retailer friendly. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we broke up the box set so much. Is the retailer said, you guys crammed so much stuff in this box set, that old introductory box set. It's like five products stuffed into one box. So like, can you break this into other products, make it cheaper, smaller, and more focused? That'll be easier to move. Obviously, with the success of Battletech that you're seeing now across all of the retail lines and stuff, they're totally right. It was the right move. So
what's the future of the premium miniatures that you and Blaine did? Is that something that's going to continue, or is there more options for that, or is that getting
That's absolutely
folded?
something that's going to continue. Yeah. So, you know, Blaine and I, a lot of people know that Blaine and I created a little company called Creative Juggernaut. And it's really a think tank for gaming products. And so we had a concept for premium miniatures line in plastic. And Lauren Coleman's the owner of Catalyst Game Labs. He's like, he didn't believe the product model. And so much of what I did when I, you know, took over as the line developer was proving product models. Like, here's how we do it. Here's a way to do it. Here's how you test the waters and stuff. And one of the most difficult things is getting baseline numbers. You have to take a risk when you're creating a product. But the idea is you don't want to take a risk on something that's so totally blind, you're really just rolling the dice. You got to do something so that you can kind of build up on it. So I had a concept for it. My creative team had a concept for what this premium line for Catalyst could be. So we did an agreement, and I pitched it to Lauren. I was like, look, my team will do all the costs on design and development. We'll figure out how to do this. We'll get the thing modeled. We'll even handle the production on the prototypes. We'll get all the initial product runs done, get them out, and we'll see how the market is. And by way of comparison, the closest thing that product fit for Catalyst was a convention exclusive. A convention exclusive product for Catalyst, they'll produce somewhere between 50 and 200 of something for sale at the show. And if the best sellers of all time, maybe 200 sales. So if they sell 50 at Gen Con, like, yeah, that was a success. That was totally great. And I told Lauren, I'm like, you need to understand, you do not, the demand for this product is significantly higher than you think. He's like, well, okay, well, I'll buy 150 of them. I'm like, okay, I can deliver you 150, but I'm telling you right now, we have 1,200 people emailing us directly saying that they want to buy this product. So I guarantee your demand is going to be 10 times what you think it is. Like, no, I don't believe it. I'll believe it when I see it. I'm like, okay. So I don't remember how many we produced, 200, 250, and we turned those over, and they sold out in 58 minutes. And I'm not kidding. They sold out in 58 minutes. And within 5 minutes, Lauren Coleman was on the call. My phone rings. Yeah, Brent. So how fast can you produce another 200 of those? That was pretty good. Because without any costs, with no absorption of resources from Catalyst, we gave him, it was like $15,000
right
on the spot. $15,000 cash with no risk. Okay, I want more of that. Like, okay. So I think we did another 200 of them. Sold out instantly. Like, all right. How fast can I get more? I'm like, okay, well, just to be clear, my little think tank is not a production company. We're here to create the prototypes to prove, get you the baseline numbers. Here's what the product can do. And so I imparted to Lauren, like, I recommend you reach out to your community. The easiest way was just to reach out to the Kickstarter backers from the first Kickstarter, right, and say, hey, here's a quick survey. Please let us know if you're interested in buying these specialty products. For the first one that we had released, the answer was 4,000 people wanted, or 4,000 people wanted to buy copies of that miniature. Well, now he had baseline numbers. Now he knew. I was like, okay, if we buy X amount of things, we can move them here. Now, that doesn't mean it will work in retail. It has to be a web exclusive, but here's how the basic numbers will work. So we did that. That worked great. He's like, okay, how fast can you make the second one? So we did the second one. We did the I don't remember which one came first. Was it the Stormcrow or the Black Knight?
The Black Knight came first, then Stormcrow, and then...
Then the Stormcrow. Okay, so yeah, Black Knight came first,
yeah.
Then we did the Stormcrow. So we sent him the Stormcrow. It sold out just as fast as the others. He's like, okay. And he's like, he offered me $20,000. He's like, I'll pay you $20,000 for as many as you can produce for these. You're like, here's the next print run. I'm like, okay, we can totally do that. But just so you know, that's taking my think tank company from a think tank company to a miniatures production company. That's not what we're here for. We're not good at that.
Yeah.
I recommend playing to your strengths. So we'll do this next batch for you so you can get those out, meet your demand while you're looking for another manufacturer, plastics manufacturer. So yeah. He reached out to John Kowaleski, who owns the Monster Fight Club. And for those that don't know, Monster Fight Club is a domestic U.S. company. John Kowaleski, who used to own Gale Force 9, founded and created it. And he has built his own plastic manufacturing shop in the U.S. So it is a domestic production, domestic plastics. Doesn't have to do all the normal plastics production stuff. And that's how you're able to get unusual things like the premium. Like the premium line had extra arms, extra legs, alternate weapon configurations, things like that. So yeah, once we proved the numbers and stuff, he turned that over to John Kowaleski with Monster Fight Club. Now, keep in mind, when my team was doing it, we were building with my hand. We were casting with my hand. So switching to a plastic injection molding process was a significant difference. So they've run into some quality control issues with that, and John Kowaleski is correcting right now and doing stuff forward. And so they've moved forward. They've done the we turned over the 3D model files for the Mad Cat, the Takeda configuration of the Mad Cat, and they've moved on beyond, and Grinner, and then they've moved on from there. So that will absolutely be an ongoing line where I expect there to always be one or two brand new premium units from Catalyst Web Store that they continue to do as, let's call it limited production run, because they know, you know, the numbers are 4,000 or less. If we're going to China to produce something now, it's, you know, we don't order less than 20,000 of anything, because, you know, but also these aren't going to distribution. These aren't going to the internationals. These are just exclusives going through the web store. They're unusual little things. But the idea there was that we could do those premium exclusive line for specialty events, like when we did Tukaid. Actually, imagine being able to release the new Tukaid source book with the maps and the Tukaid specialty miniatures side by side within 60 days of each other. Battletech's never had that. Most game companies don't have anything close to that. Usually they'd be waiting, you know, 1.5 to 2 years for Ironwood Metals to be producing miniatures from that event. Mm-hmm. But having them closer together and actually done through the same distribution channel is totally unique. So, yeah, that is something that Catalyst absolutely will be continuing to do moving forward. I don't know that they're going to continue to use Monster Fight Club, or if they're going to be looking for a secondary production thing, only because Monster Fight Club is John's company is growing. He's expanding his stuff. He's got a lot of stuff. And I don't know how much longer he'll be able to continue to dedicate bandwidth to producing stuff for this. But yeah, one way or the other, we've now proven the model. We've proven the revenue stream. We've proven the demand for it. The fans have come to expect that, oh yeah, they have the ability to go to the web store and buy something, you know, cool and unique. And yeah, you'll pay more for it, but it gives you more options than you normally would with a pre-assembled right out of the box kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, that actually was a big success. And it did exactly for like Creative Juggernaut. That showed exactly what Creative Juggernaut is good at. We create cool concepts for games. We prove the product, we prove the business model, and we turn them over, or we take them and turn them into something else. So that allowed my team to hand that off and then focus on to our releases with Land and Sea, getting our, you know, first major franchise off. And we've had, you know, books 1, 2, 3, and 4 release January, February, March, and April of this year. I've never seen anybody launch a brand new IP with back-to-back month, back-to-back novels dropping that to create the foundation. So that's something my team could not have done if we were also trying to produce miniatures for Catalyst.
Right.
Not enough hands. So, yeah.
Have you guys explored dropships and doing dropships at that 1 to 65 scale?
Yes. Yes,
excellent. We have. I look forward to it.
To be continued. Oh, yes.
Very cool. Well, I have a fun project.
One of the funniest things is, not only did we, so Spooky, those of you know, Spooky 77 is one of our artists, phenomenal artist. He's one of the best creators we work with. He actually built the full size mech scale, not map scale, mech scale dropship with internals and everything. And we're like, yeah, that's great. Can you cut it into a bunch of little pieces for us? We're like, break it apart. Like, what? Like, yeah, no, like, we want to do this map set with all these crash dropships and all these bits where it broke up. And he's like, oh man, you're making me cut this thing apart. So yes, we are. And the first thing we did with it is I think the first time the fans are going to get to see the dropship is broken on a map.
Awesome. That'd be exciting. We talked about the early days of CGL when you guys were just source books. There are some wonderful source books from that period. And I know you've re-released some. You know, for those, you know, the kind of The alternative, of course, is kind of the eBay, the secondary market. Kind of for those that are like myself, that are patient and happy to wait for things to come out, you know, but would still like to have those things. Are there any that you know just aren't going to be released from that, reprinted from that era, and that, you know, go ahead and pull the trigger on finding secondary market versus stuff that you, you know, like the First and Second Succession Wars, both amazing source books that you've already released?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So there's actually multiple answers to that question. Mm-hmm. The first one is that for the Catalyst era source books that are now out of print, like the ones we already did the print runs, they are sold out. They're good. I believe there is a print on demand option either now for them, or that they all will be cycled over to print on demand.
Okay.
So the people can just order. It doesn't make sense for us to order a print run of 1500 if it's sitting in our warehouse for 7 years while we're waiting to do the sell through on that one. It's print on demand is so good now, like that. It is amazing how good they are.
Right.
So that's a great way to go with that. And ultimately for the Catalyst ones that we control, because we have all the layout files on that, mm-hmm. that's the way to go. And the answer to that one is yes, that's easy. I personally would like to see a few of those as we get past the next couple of years. I would like to see us redo a few of those in the same way that we did the Tukaid source book. Because if you saw the overhaul we did to the Tukaid source book in full color, fully rendered with the star mass travel, all the things involved in that, it was amazing. And I would love to see us give that treatment to a couple of those, like Wars of Reaving, Operation Klondike. You know, some of those really fantastic ones, maybe First and Second Succession War kind of things. But those are all stuff that from our era, I would like to see those brought in the new one, but they should still be available in the old version as print on demands. The second part of that is the pre-Catalyst era. Fan Pro went earlier. And honestly, Fan Pro is really hit and miss. A lot of the files were either lost or sucked. But those still can be transitioned. It's the early ones. I don't know if most people are aware of this. It hurts to even admit it. Back in the early day of FAST, like the FASTA era and stuff, they didn't have digital files. The archives, for the most part, had been lost. All of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the only digital files, and we've seen it's boxes of like those little 3.5-inch floppy disks. They're all corrupted. There's no getting data off any of that. So all the early stuff, it is literally us mining our own personal collections and scanning the books.
Yeah.
Or the real answer is that we will need to rebuild those from scratch. And that doesn't mean the text. I mean, layout, art, text, everything. And that's ultimately where those have tripped up. That's why those aren't available already. Because we wanted those available 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But the rebuilding process, our layout team is so swamped. I don't know that DAC has come up for air in like 7 years. It's ridiculous. So yeah, we will need to dramatically upscale our layout team to be able to handle the complete relayout of those old products in order to get those back to where they could be print on demand. Did it. So yeah, it will all get there. It will absolutely get there. It's something we're currently working on. We have been working on for 5 years. But I don't have a time on when I would say that is expected to be done, because there's a massive library to that.
Awesome. Yeah, it's like things like the error reports and the field manuals, they go for big money and they're very high quality. They're great reads. I just loved reading.
Do they really?
Yeah,
I had no idea they went for big money.
Yeah, field manual Starleague is like $140, $150 book. The error reports, depending on which error report, can go anywhere from $60 to $140 on eBay.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's a,
the amazing thing there is that, you know, we have the PDFs available. They're all cheap. They're not expensive.
Yeah. Put them on drive through. You'll make money. It'll be another.
There are.
Yeah.
Oh, for on drive through.
No. Yeah. For like the print on demand. Well, I think Well, I haven't checked recently, but I know I got the
but
first
not as
and second
permanent. They're
succession
PDFs.
war as print on demand. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, a lot of people like the physical prints. So that's where I was heading with that.
Yeah.
But excellent. Well, Brent, I've run through my questions and I've had a lot of fun. I appreciate the time that you gave and yeah, all the work that you've done, you know, for yeah, for helping revive BattleTech. It's been fun as a fan to enjoy it. It's been fun as a producer to kind of spread the love and to kind of enjoy what you guys have been up to.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for all that you do to keep BattleTech alive and thriving. You know, people blowing each other up on tabletop battlefields around the world.
Definitely. Definitely. It's fun and we'll keep doing it. Well, this is Travis signing off, everybody. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Brent, thanks again. And we'll catch you on the next episode.
Sounds good. Back on.
ETA dropship, 1 minute. Shutdown sequence initiated.